ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan, at the completion of an absurd test match which is over inside 2 days. The side that was behind in the test for large periods ends up winning inside 2 days by 8 wickets. How on earth are we meant to make sense of all of that? Ed Cowan joins me. He's back from the United States. Teddy, where do I possibly start? It's so good to see you, firstly.
Corb, it is great to see you. I'm speechless, to be honest. I mean, I watched every single ball today. I tried to sneak in a little afternoon nap, but Australia by that stage felt like they were taking a wicket every 7 or 8 balls. And then the evening session was obviously as captivating as cricket can really get. So what to make of that day? I don't know. Get me back on a plane. Get me in that change room. I'd be spraying the beer all over Travis Head, because that was, I think, the greatest test innings I've ever seen.
I got to interview him post-game on the ABC's coverage with Jason Gillespie and Darren Lehman, who, of course, are native South Australians. And even as we record this, I'm actually watching him just walk around in the middle of Perth Stadium at the moment with his shoes off, FaceTiming, I'm sure, loved ones back home. But alongside those two South Australian cricketing legends, you would be front and centre, unabashed president of the Travis Head fan club. You've often teased the idea about him possibly opening the batting. Has the answer to Australia's problems at the top of the order been hiding in plain sight?
Well, hindsight makes fools or geniuses of us all, Corb. And in this case, it's easy to look back and say, you know, he's the answer. I don't think we've teased it in the past. I think we've actually put a decent-sized flag in the ground, and particularly in either two types of conditions. One are the slower wickets of the subcontinent, or the other end of the spectrum is the hard, bouncy wickets of WA and the Gabba, and Australia more broadly, I guess. So it's a tricky one for the selectors from here, but I think it's very hard not to see how that can play out for the rest of the series. Particularly the way England attack him with the ball, it gives him a little bit more time to settle in, get going. I will say on his batting, I mean, people will remember the last 70 runs, let's say. What you don't want to take away was the quality of the first 50 and how still he was and how late he played and how decisive he was. Yes, he had a game plan, but it wasn't outrageous. England served up, probably two different lengths, and he leapt all over it, and he played superbly. He played late, he played straight, and when they gave him width, my goodness, did he leap all over it. And then he just got going, and he was in the zone, and after that, they couldn't stop him.
It was a phenomenal innings, and it was one that came in a test match where scoring was tough, clearly. 172 England all out inside 33 overs. Australia batting 45.2 overs all out, 132. So 40-run differential in the first innings, and then England all out for 164. So that is the moment that he walks to the crease. At that stage, only one player had scored a half century. Only two players had passed 40. And he peels off 169 balls, the equal third fastest in the history of the game. I mean, in the history of Australia's involvement in test matches. So with that as the backdrop, to then come out and play in that kind of fashion, it's a great point you make. That, and he mentioned with us post-game that he played like a proper opener at the start. It wasn't as if he was just absolutely blazing from ball one.
Yeah, I wasn't joking when I said I've seen some things in cricket. I was lucky enough to be at the other end when Dave Warner scored, I don't know, it was probably an 80-ball 100 at the Wacker in 2011 on a green monster as well. And this gazumped that. Fourth innings, pressure situation. I know you said that, you know, the batting was tough. I actually think the batting was poor in parts, and we'll come to it, and maybe it's the segue. England, in many respects, gifted this game to Australia. 100 ahead at lunch, one down. It didn't take much, really, to drag themselves back into the game. It wasn't brilliance with the ball. It was just a decent game plan, well executed. And England played with their ego and not with their brains, and this was always going to be the risk. And that risk backfired today. They I'm happy to probably use the words. I think they gifted the game to Australia at that point, and clearly not taking anything away from Head's innings and Labuschagne's innings. But if they get 300 or 330 ahead, the game's over.
So did Australia fight their way back into the game, or did England let them in? Like, I know there's a combination of both, but which one do you lean into more?
No, I'm far more the latter. Okay, so they're one down at lunchtime. What did Australia do? They just went wide. They bowled fourth stump, fifth stump, sometimes wider and back of a length. There was nothing brilliant there, and they got caught up in the intensity and probably a bit of mental fogginess as wickets fell, much like it felt, you know, the day before with Australia in that evening session. So, I mean, I'd love to hear your views of the ground. It feels like I've done a lot of talking. It must have been an amazing game to call, the ebbs and the flows. I mean, what's your view on the sense of England handing the game back versus Australia, you know, snatching it out of their hands?
It just, I mean, we talk a lot about the baseball philosophy, and it just felt like another occasion where, at the end of the day, there are certain moments where you've just got to be able to take the game away from the opposition and grind them into the dirt. And after lunch, when they had two guys set at the crease, that was the time where you thought, by stumps tonight, England have the chance to be completely on top in this game and basically put Australia in a position where they can't win. And instead, they were all out by tee, and all of a sudden, it was sort of one after the other, and you thought, where is this resistance going to come from? Where's the moment where someone's going to stand up and say, this is not happening to us? And again, what we talk about, the value of winning and losing, where you think, for everything that baseball represents, where was that today? Where they were in a position to win and put their flag in the ground, to use your analogy from earlier, to start a series and get themselves off onto the right foot. And by the same token, as much as we would ordinarily sit back and say this is a loss that potentially could, you know, change the series and it could all be over for England immediately, and you know, morale could be crushed and that'll be a snowball effect for the remainder of the series, I kind of feel like this England team doesn't play like that. Like, they're as likely to sort of put that completely out of their minds and front up, and it's a new test again come Brisbane. They're clearly not the better team. I think we learnt that again today if both teams play their best cricket. But it's just so completely foreign, I think, almost to the extreme or to the absurd, to all the psychology we're used to in sport, for the way things are meant to pan out and what's meant to be your North Star, which is ultimately winning.
Yeah, and if they make no mistake, if they bat like that again, as we expect them to, that they will lose 5-0. Because in the history of the game in Australia, you can't attack the ball on fourth or fifth stump on a 6-metre length and expect not to nick the ball consistently. You might hit one, you might hit two, but by goodness, you're not hitting three or four. And so it's brainless, it's full of ego and bravado, and they need to start, you know, really using their brains because they've got the skill. You watch Harry Brook bat, you watch Joe Root bat, they just need to get in the contest and be mindful of the ebbs and flow of the game to which they're playing. So, I mean, you got to remember, this is also a team that, you know, has been bowled out, what, in 30 overs and 30 overs. They got bowled out in 30 overs three times in New Zealand in the ODI tour. So they're not full of confidence themselves. They've actually lost what baseball represents, and that is putting pressure on the bowlers. But that can also be done by not getting out for periods of time. You don't have to try and hit their best ball or the moment that they go to their plan B. Just let the natural ebbs and flow of the game take course. It's great to watch as an Australian fan, because we thought that they would be nuanced in their approach, and today showed that wasn't going to be the case.
So momentum in the series is fascinating, obviously, now from an Australian point of view as to what happens next. But before we move on from all of this, and there's so many aspects to pick up on, the bowling from Australia today, so Stark, sensational when Australia need him. His two running mates, obviously, absent in Cummins and Hazelwood, and he takes career best figures, 7 for 58, and then backs it up with 3 in the second dig to give him 10 for the match. But it felt like all the questions that were raised on day one, where you thought, you know, could Australia handle, as you call them, the nasty fasties for England on the second day? Well, tick that box. All of a sudden, they don't look as fearsome at stumps on day two as they looked at stumps on day one. And Scott Boland, who was really a big question mark, and Trent Copeland spoke about that last night. What a response from him to come back and bowl a disciplined line, pick up four wickets, and all of a sudden he looks like he's back in rhythm, and it felt like Australia answered a few of the questions in a single day that were raised at stumps last night.
A quick sidebar, I listened to the breakdown as I landed, and it was just an electric rap from you and Cope, so thanks to Copes for filling in. But to kind of break that down, you know, and Copes touched on it, Scott Boland with the new ball actually probably bowled exactly what he should have bowled, and that was pitch the ball up, make them drive, and, you know, if they get away, so be it, but let's get three or four by lunch. It doesn't suit his bowling, make no mistake. He's a back of the length, thump it in there kind of guy, and that's what we got today. We saw his natural length today. He actually did the team thing yesterday, because when there's moisture in the wicket, you got to get the ball up and get them driving. So it probably looked like he served them up a little bit, but it would have been far worse if he was, you know, 6 to 8 meter length and they left him all day. We didn't know that they were going to come probably as hard as they did. And today, all he had to do was bowl exactly what Scott Boland loves bowling. Fourth stump, back of a length, and the England batters did the rest. There was, you know, a good piece of execution to go along with those tactics. And, you know, two balls earlier, he could have had him out LBW as well. So, you know, it was an excellent comeback, but it's someone who knows what they're doing. We've got to give him a bit of credit. He didn't have a great day yesterday, but he did probably what the game plan was.
We'll get to Usman Khawaja in just a moment and what on earth went on there in this test match. But hey, hats off to Manus Labuschagne. He's one of our favourites. He got a half century in the second innings. Big tick for Boland on the comeback. Big tick for Travis Head, clearly. Steve Smith wins again as captain. So it's the seventh test match that he's skippered now since his return to the top job. Obviously, he was replaced after the episodes in South Africa. And since Cummins has been absent over a number of series now, he's deputised, and Australia haven't lost any of those test matches. They've won more than they've drawn, and he's undefeated through the seven matches so far. What to make of the first inning? So all out 132, 45.2 overs. There was the chaos at the start that Usman wasn't eligible to open. So Manus walks out there and they were in a tailspin from that point on. And by 45.2 overs, the whole thing was done and they were 40 runs behind in the test match. How much does all's well ends well and you just move on, they win the test, everyone's feeling good about themselves, and how much of that is sort of wallpapering over the cracks if what happened in the first innings is ignored?
Yeah, I obviously didn't see it live, but I saw enough to probably comment. It felt almost what England suffered from today, Australia suffered from yesterday, and that was under pressure. They had some brain fog as to what their game plans were. And we saw some, you know, softer wickets that would have been pretty frustrating to watch if you're at the ground and an Australian fan. So, you know, the cracks are, that's nothing new, but we also know what's possible. And to see Labuschagne at three and Smith at four and both in great form, that warms the heart. And I think what would have happened, as you said, in a tailspin, Khawaja doesn't open, and everyone moves up one. A lot of mental preparation goes into where you're going to bat, and you know it's not quite as, you know, cognitively flexible as you probably think it is, and so that I think that played into it. And you know, on the flip side, Travis Head putting his hand up for the team today, not for the output, but hey, what is best for the team is we have Labuschagne at three and Smith at four, and I'm going to do something that, you know, is not that far out of the box, but for me, it's putting the team ahead of individual performance, and look what happened.
It was a bizarre day where the initial reporting was, look, he's off for stretching and toilet breaks, and then all of a sudden it emerged later in the day that actually he's had back spasms, and that's why it was off the ground for that period. But we've got the vision of Smith where he's clearly signalling towards the pavilion and clued into the fact that, hey, these last five wickets are falling quickly. Where's Uzi? Like, he needs to be out here to open the batting. That's what he's in the team for. Then we learn a little bit more that all of a sudden he was playing golf the day before, which you can draw into that narrative what you will, and I'm keen to get your take on it. But he won the comp at Carinup leading in. Mitchell Starc played on the same day, and Mitchell Starc came out and took 7 foot. Usman Khawaja found himself with back spasms. And then, obviously, in the second day, which turned out to be the final day of the test match, he leaps in the air trying to take a catch off a cut shot from Jamie Smith, clearly aggravates his bat again and walks off. So we see him once in the test match batting at four. He faces 6 balls and he's out for two. And the guy who's the makeshift opener in the second innings peels off a match-winning 100. To be a fly on the wall in that dressing room as all of that's going down, take me inside what happens there. Like, who decides that Uzi's coming off the ground? Is that something the player calls himself? And then when he's off the ground, is it up to the physio to keep him? Does the coach need to step in and say, hey, Uzi, get back out on the ground? It just, there's so much of it that just feels like an absolute botch up in the way that they all panned out, that he wasn't there to open at the time that he needed to be in the first innings.
Yeah, and I feel you covered this well yesterday, and I was pretty happy with your comments this morning. You certainly didn't miss, not just you, but I thought the whole commentary team covered this pretty well. And you're right, it's probably a lot of those inputs. So, I mean, first things first, playing cricket with a back spasm is nigh on impossible. And increasingly, the older you get, the unfitter you get, the more you get them. And so whatever the cause was, it's sidebar, pretty bad look playing golf the day before, and then having any injury, forget the back, anything that, people can join those dots and then tell a story around is just a bad look. And so irrespective of that, in the moment he would have felt his back go, and that's a pretty, having experienced this, it's a situation that, a little bit of panic goes into your mind, because generally speaking, it takes between 24 and 36 hours for these spasms to die down, and you're totally debilitated depending on how bad it is. And so, once you're off, the physio says, well, you got to do the bare minimum to get back on to at least give yourself the option. So I think there was definitely a little bit of a cock up on the timing element. But, looking forward, I think it just brings into question his fitness and his ability to play, back-to-back tests and 5 days of cricket, and all of a sudden the person that took his spot got 100. So, I think that is going to be the story that people are talking about leading into Brisbane. Because he dropped a catch as well. So forget jumping, the one that he jumped over. One hit him in the chest that he bobbled. He dropped one that was a bit of a sober today. And he just looks as though his eyes and his hands aren't working as one.
And to think that we were trying to find him a partner at the top of the order, and now all of a sudden you think, hang on, this could open up a spot in the middle, and all of a sudden, whether it's Bo Webster or Josh Inglis or whoever it turns out to be, that it might present the chance for Australia to have, at least on paper, what looks to be an improved lineup. As much as we would love Uzi to sail off into the sunset from a personal point of view for him in Sydney and get the fairy tale farewell, all of a sudden there's a new set of circumstances that might stand in the way of Usman getting there.
Yeah, new data makes for new decisions. There's no doubt about that. I think you were the one of the two of us that had locked that in. I was always needling away in the background to suggest that there's been a pretty solid decline in the output. But, putting that aside, it's going to be the talking point, I think, no doubt, for the next couple of weeks. And it doesn't help that the next test, mate, if it was a back-to-back test, I think he's more likely to play. But the old adage, you never change a winning team, but if Cummins comes back in, there are a few changes anyway. It's no one's ever bigger than the team, Corb, that, and they need to pick the best team to win the next game, and with that the Ashes will be well and truly done.
The idea of these late night records, obviously, Teddy, at the end of the day, is to get your analysis on what we've just seen. So we'll obviously keep it a little shorter today. I imagine we'll chat again on Monday. So we'll have our usual drop there in right here on the ABC Cricket Podcast. And then we got our live show, which was meant to be day six, which feels ages away at the Olympic Hotel on Wednesday night. So all of that's still to come this week. And 12 days, basically, before the Brisbane Test match gets underway. Just, I know this is in your wheelhouse. So I just want to ask you this one. I had the chat to Mike Baird. So Cricket Australia lost $11.3 million last year. You love sort of financing sport and all the rest of it. They lose 2 days of basically near sellouts in a almost 60,000 seat stadium. So already a record attendance, despite the fact it's only a 2 day test. 49,983 on the second day puts it over 100,000. So we've never had a test match in Western Australia that's drawn as many people as the 2 days here. But Cricket Australia are going to have to refund all those tickets plus the corporate support for those 2 days as well. And people at CA were antsy going into the second day about not having day four. They're not going to have day three either. How significant is that for the association to miss out on something like that?
Well, you can do the maths pretty quickly because these tickets aren't cheap. I mean, the Goldilocks situation is 3.5 days. So, you know, lunchtime, day three, they only budget for 4 days now. So, in fact, you know, the big issue last year was when the Melbourne test goes to 5 days and there's a whole heap of costs that go into actually opening the gates for 2 hours and no one really turns up anyway. So this is the other end of the spectrum. 2 days is not ideal for the bottom line, but at the same time, in the scheme of things, it's not make or break because, you know, your main revenue drivers are, of course, broadcast and sponsorship. So, look, I think we want games to go more than 2 days. I'm sure Rick Finlay and the team were talking. I mean, I can't remember a game that was decided inside 2 days in Australia. Can you?
One in recent memory, but there was also this is the first Ashes test, Rick told us, a 2 day Ashes test in Australia since 1890. So there's a reason why you can't recall too many. 1890, it's a long way back. The Green Monster, Teddy, at the Gabba. We had a 2 day test match December 2022 against South Africa, where it was way too green. But we spoke about the pitch, obviously, a fair bit last night on the pod with Copes, and he gave some great data about, you know, consistency ratings. And I made the point about, you know, if this was in India, what would we be saying? At no stage did it feel like that the pitch was a major talking point, even though the game was in fast forward from the jump.
Yeah, with good reason. It was an absolute ripper. Yes, it had pace. Yes, it had bounce. But a little bit of graft, old-fashioned graft. Call me old-fashioned, but, you know, when someone's bowling fourth of his stump, there's only one way they can get you out, and that's if you hang your bat out there. And so get some overs into them, boys, and make them come back tomorrow. But, you know, the modern game, it's changed, that's for sure.
Corps Curry Club, before we get out of here, so average of 26 for Harry Brook. He got 52 in the first innings, but then a big globe in the second dig, so a third baller. And I thought, Teddy, and maybe I'm biased and I've got my orange-coloured glasses on, but I thought Ollie Pope looked as well organised as just about any batsman in the match for England with a couple of starts.
He played pretty well. And maybe, you know, we can kind of go line by line on our Monday show. But he did look organised because he was actually willing to let the bowlers come to him. His undoing was when he got caught up in the baseball moments, when he was actually leaving well and making the bowlers bowl to him and tuck him off his pads. You know, it's almost like it's 1998 again. Just a little bit of patient batting. But he played nicely. I think England, I think we got caught off guard as to how good England's bowling can be, and I think we've probably overestimated how good England's batting can be.
Teddy, we might leave it on that note. I have no idea what your body clock would possibly be, so I'll let you get to bed in Sydney, but it's kind of the middle of the night or the morning on your body clock where you've been in the United States, so I appreciate you staying up, and I might get out of here and have a little beverage after an amazing test match all over inside 2 days. Appreciate your insights as always.
Corb, go enjoy yourself. Loved the call. I'm sorry I wasn't here last night, but there's nothing better to get back on the time zone than watching a hell of a day of test cricket. Long live test cricket. That was brilliant.
Every Monday and Friday, our summer cadence here on the ABC Cricket Podcast. And of course, at the completion of every single day's play like this one, thanks Josh Hansen for all his work. And of course, to Fletcher Doherty, thanks to you, Ed Cowan. I will chat to you come Monday.
Later.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.